Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
How you doing, Aaron?
Doing good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I had an easy day today, so that always makes life better.
Just before we get started here, I'd like to give a shout out to Skip for his great donation. We really appreciate it. He's one of our really interesting listeners. He gives feedback on quite a few of our episodes, so it's much appreciated. So shout out to you, Skip. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Tonight's topic is something that I grew up with, knowing this folktale and this, or not even folktale, this real story, and it made an impression on me. And I have to say that my opinion changed a little bit about it, but for the most part, it's the same from when I was a little kid, just kind of being mesmerized by the story. And something that you suggested, and I was so happy when we started to do this. So what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Well, the story, I may have suggested it to cover this week, but it had been suggested to us by listeners. When you look up unsolved cases that have nothing to do with murder, this is right at the top. And this is the case of D.B. Cooper, or as he would tell you, Dan Cooper. The story is about a man who purchased a one-way ticket from Portland, Oregon to Seattle. It cost him less than $20. He paid for it with $20. And he boarded the plane. His seat was towards the very back of the plane. And while he's waiting for it to take off, he's told he needs to stow his attaché case under the seat. Well, it turns out that this gentleman has a note for the flight attendant, and she accepts it. Although she doesn't read it right away because she thinks, great, someone else is hitting on me, probably has just given me his phone number, and she has a job to do. So she's not that interested. She stows it away. But shortly thereafter, he lets her know she needs to read this note. And it turns out that it's a note that's written in felt tip ink in block letters, so they're all capitalized. It's a very ominous note because at this point, hijackings are not, you could say they're not common. This isn't something that's happening all the time. Nowadays, we immediately think of terrorism. And while we don't really know his motivations, we can say that he was a threat to everyone on that plane. His note read, "I have a bomb. I will use it if necessary. I want you to sit next to me. You are being hijacked." And so he needs her to sit with him so he can make his demands. And then she can relay those demands to the pilot. And his demands are, He wants $200,000 in $20 bills, and he also wants four parachutes, two back chutes and two front chutes. And back chutes are primary parachutes. When you jump, this is what you would wear. The front chute is a secondary chute, and it's more of an emergency chute.
A reserve chute, yeah.
A reserve chute is the proper term for it. So if they jump and the primary chute, if something happens with that, you have a secondary chute. And the secondary chute, from what I understand, it has even more stringent guidelines on how it's put together and how it operates, because it's your last chance if you ever have to use it. It's the last thing between you and death. So it has to work.
This guy hijacks an airplane, and he does it on Thanksgiving, essentially, which I found that kind of telling, because there's a lot of people flying. There's a lot of traffic going on. I think that was a perfect date. I mean, and also there's a 4-day weekend, essentially. You got Thursday, Friday off, and then Saturday and Sunday. So he picks that day, right, to give him some time to pull off this caper.
Thanksgiving Eve.
Yeah, Thanksgiving Eve. So there's a lot of people flying. There's a lot of family out and about. A lot of people are at home. So he chooses this day to pull off his hijacking.
And yeah, in 1971, it's not, as I said, it's not a time where this is something they're used to. So the way they deal with it is interesting, because they have to make a lot of choices here. This man says he has a bomb. Well, he shows the flight attendant the bomb. In the attaché case on the left side are what look to be like dynamite sticks, something like that, with wiring and going to a large flashlight battery. So it looks very threatening. It looks like something he could detonate. And on a plane like that, which is the plane itself is a 727, and this factors heavily into the case, because it's not by accident that he chose this particular flight. He chose this flight because it's a 727, and it has a unique feature, at least at that time, which was aft stairs, which are these stairs that can be lowered at the back of the plane.
Back in the day, the people got off on the tarmac. The stairwell would come out of the plane, and people would walk down the stairwell and walk across the... Essentially, we didn't have those big, huge, hallways that rolled up on the side of the plane. So an easy way for people to get off the plane was the stairwell that dropped down the back, and they'd all exit out the back. And this plane had that. So essentially, it's like five or six steps that just kind of, come down, and he can exit the plane using these stairs.
They would have mobile stairs they can move up to the airplane, but if they were at a location where they didn't have those, or if they weren't available, they could lower the aft stairs and people could exit that way.
Yeah.
So it's a nice little option.
And again, you mentioned that plane hijackings were not a standard thing back then. And in the 1960s, there were a handful of hijackings that happened in America, and it was mostly people trying to get to another country, or maybe there were political things, Cuba, whatever. But it wasn't the first hijacking in American history. And I hear that a lot when people say this is the first hijacking, on American soil. And that's incorrect. They were happening in the 1960s also, but it was just a handful of them. But once 1970s hit, that seemed to be the Wild West of air hijackings. So, and this kind of kicked it off, this D.B. Cooper's case. So he has this bomb, and he makes these demands. They're going from Portland to Seattle, right?
Right.
So he's pretty much telling the Seattle authorities to have the money, have the parachutes, have his demands met by the time they land, right? And so they land at the Seattle airport, and at that point, I think he lets all the hostages go, or all the passengers go on the airplane.
Right, but the authorities at this point, they wondered what they should do. Should they give him parachutes that don't work, or should they try to trick him? Should they try and storm the plane and take it? There were different ideas, but in the end, they decided they didn't want to have any unnecessary deaths, any unnecessary trouble. So they thought perhaps if they just give him what he's asking for, no one will die, and then they can get him later. This Dan Cooper was very careful not to leave his notes behind. He made sure if he had a note for someone, he made sure he got it back, so that he was careful about the evidence, you could say.
And something that I felt was interesting was how he came across to the flight crew. He was a chain smoker. He ordered a bourbon and soda, or bourbon on the rocks. And he had a threatening letter, and he did show off a bomb in a suitcase, but he was very polite, and he didn't pull a gun. He didn't threaten, you know, he wasn't threatening in a verbal sense. And he was, I would almost call him a professional criminal at that point. There was no need for unnecessary death. And that's, you know, so, but of course the authorities have no idea what they're dealing with. So yeah, they're deciding, well, should we give him what he wants, or should we give him bogus stuff? Should we raid the airplane and gun him down? You know, they're trying to figure out how to handle the situation.
There was actually an amount of time, almost 2 hours, while they had to circle the airport before they landed to pick up the items he had requested. Mm-hmm. And during that time, one of the flight attendants in the main cabin were Tina Mucklow and Florence Schaffner. And in the first class cabin, it was Alice Hancock. But even though he handed the note to Florence Schaffner in the beginning, Tina Mucklow is the one who sat with him the entire time that they were circling. And it seemed as though she was the one that was lighting his cigarettes for him. After all, he had his hand ready to trigger that bomb if need be.
Yeah. So they land, and how did the authorities deal with him?
Well, they don't. When they land, he sends flight attendant out to get the items that he had asked for, the parachutes and the money. There are 10,000 bills, so quite a bit of cash. In today's terms, that $200,000 would be well over $1 million. From what I understand, she drugged it into the plane.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was because she just didn't want to carry the weight. Who knows what her mood was, but you could say that Tina Mucklow was someone who later it was said that she had been cool, calm, and collected the entire time. But in this situation that they weren't really prepared for, I think everyone was just dealing with it the best way they could. And that was just be really cool with him, don't cause any trouble. And apparently he even tried to tip the flight attendants, but they all refused. Each of them refused any money he tried to give them. They said it was against policy.
The authorities, though, they were kind of tricky here, because they picked a certain lot of serial numbers for the $20 bills, and they actually recorded every single one in that time for them to gather the money and the parachutes. So they knew that if they gave this guy this money, if he spent it anywhere, they could track it. They could figure out where it was. And that must have just been a astronomical effort on their end to get this lot of 10,000 bills and find a batch of them and then record each one before this plane landed. I was really impressed that they actually went to that level, because in today's time, it would be where assigning, you know, a SWAT team to go raid the plane and kill the guy, and they wouldn't take the time to take 10,000 bills and record each one. So, and that comes.
Yeah,
they
used a Recordac machine, and it takes pictures, they say, at a high rate of speed and turns those images into microfilm. So yes, they documented every bill that was going to him.
Pretty cool. Even for 1970s.
Well, another interesting aspect here is, so he's made these demands. They have to come up with parachutes. You can't just say, oh, let me go grab some. They have to figure out where to get these from.
And it's a Thursday night, Thanksgiving Eve. You know, it's going to be hard.
Right. So what they do is they end up finding a skydiver. And they say, you know, here's what we need. Can you help us with this? So he did. One of the primary parachutes was more of a sporting one that you had a lot of control with when you deployed it. You could actually steer your way through the air, basically. And the other one was more of a military model where it was good for slowing your descent, but you didn't really have any control. And it was also rougher on you. So when you deploy the chute and the straps yank on you, it's a rougher deployment than the sporting one would be.
Yeah, it's just a drop chute, and the military doesn't really care too much about comfort and convenience.
Right, that's a good way to put it. And then there's the two front parachutes, and one of those is actually a dummy chute. I think it's because that's all the guy had. He didn't have four working shoots to give. So one of those was a dummy shoot. It actually was marked with an X, and the suit, the parachute itself was sewn up so it wouldn't be deployable.
It's just a training shoot to kind of train classes with, you know, on a tabletop. Yeah.
Yeah. They could take it out and toss it up in the air and just to get them familiar with parachute before they actually, he says, you know, when they use it in training, it's easier for him to go and collect it and pack it back away rather than use a chute that's fully deployable. That would be a lot messier to deal with.
So whether intentionally or non-intentionally, in their haste, they grab these four chutes and one of them happens to be a training or dummy chute. All right.
Right, because there was talk of, should we give them all dummy chutes? Mm-hmm. But when you don't have, from what I understand, they don't have a million chutes to choose from. You could plan whatever you want, but you don't have those choices. So you just have to go with what you have.
Yeah.
And this man actually ended up hearing about this, you know, through the news service and saying, oh, there go my parachutes. And he thought, this guy's nuts. Because let's talk about this. So he gives them more instructions. He now has his money. He has the parachutes. And he says, fly to Mexico. And he gives them specific instructions on how to do that.
Oh, yeah, like the flaps at 15 degrees. And he wants the landing gear down and the stairway down, and they pretty much tell him no.
They tell him that they can fly at the altitude he wants.
At the speed he wants. He wants
at
them
the speed he wants, that with the landing gear down. But they said there are two problems. One is that the aft stairwell cannot be down. And at first he says, oh, yes, it can. But they say no. And so he seems to give up on that one and just say, okay, fine. And then they say the other problem is we won't be able to fly. As an example, it would be like, we can't fly 2,500 miles like this.
Yeah.
Because with the landing gear down and the flaps like you want and at the altitude you want, it's going to create more drag. So we can only go about 1,000 miles.
Yeah, it'll
so
burn,
we'll have to refuel.
Yeah, it'll burn way more fuel. And so, yeah. So they decide to stop in Reno, Nevada to do the refueling.
That's what they're planning.
Yeah.
And then he seems to just agree right away. Like, okay, that's, you know, that's fine.
I mean, do they not understand, like, the guy is asking for parachutes. He's asking them to fly at 10,000 feet at a really slow rate of speed. Isn't it obvious that he's going to jump?
That's what I was thinking, too, when I was reading this. That's a great point. It just seemed like he's letting them know, hey, I'm not going to be around very long. Mm-hmm. He asks Tina Mucklow to go up front and to close the divider, the curtain between first class and the rest of the cabin.
Yeah.
And she says the last thing she saw was that he had taken some of the cords from one of the secondary chutes. And she didn't give all these details, but this is what we work out, is he was tying something around near his waist, which was, it seemed as though he was probably securing the money to himself. Yeah. Using some of the cords from one of the secondary chutes.
And then they say that about half an hour into the flight, there was a pressure change, which kind of signifies that the back stairwell has been lowered. And then the plane tips, kind of like weight has been dropped off of it. And that's about half hour into it. So at that point, we can kind of assume he's dropped the back stairwell and he's jumped off.
Yeah, there's a point at which they try to call back to him using the intercom, and there is no answer.
Yeah.
And it's around 8:12 p.m., they believe, that this happens. And if you like it, to give you a really good idea of what this is like, look up a 727 on the internet. The stairwell isn't it's not a long stairwell. And it comes out the very back end of the plane, tucks neatly away, and then when it comes out, it just sort of drops down some. So it's not a long flight of stairs, as you might imagine. It's actually fairly short.
And something, another sneaky thing the authorities did was they sent other planes to track and follow the 727, you know, on its flight path. Jet planes, but they were supposed to hang back at a safe distance and track this plane, which I'm assuming that would have been pretty hard because he told them to fly this plane at a certain altitude at right above stall speed. So these jets are probably having to, you know, they're having to probably fly circles just to keep back or fly around the 727 because that's their stall speed too. So I wonder how that went. But anyways, they're behind the jet, and this is the Northwest. So it's cold and it's rainy that night. So there's cloud cover, whatever. So they're doing their best to follow this plane that D.B. Cooper's on. None of the other pilots saw anything. You know, they were either too far away or it was just too cloudy and rainy that night.
Yeah, there was a storm going on, and I believe it said that the wind force was 200 miles an hour and that the temperature that he was throwing himself into was about -7.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's 200 miles per hour because that's how fast the plane's going. And then you add wind shear of the storm, and then you had the water, and then you add wind chill. Faster the wind's blowing, the colder it's going to feel. So yeah, it's not a pleasant thing that he's jumping into right now.
And he's not dressed for this weather either.
Oh, we didn't say what he was wearing. He was wearing a business suit.
Well, this is what they wore back then. Yeah. When people traveled, they dressed up.
Yeah.
They looked presentable. And he was dressed in a suit. Depending on what you read, either a sport coat or a trench coat or a light rain jacket. And he was wearing loafers. For much of the time that he was on board the plane, he had donned sunglasses. We have a description of him, but it's kind of iffy because different people saw different things. And so you have composite sketches. I would say one of the most interesting descriptions that I read was from someone who was he owned a paint store in Seattle, and he was sitting right across from Cooper. And apparently he really checked him out to see who this person was. And the official description, before I tell you what Robert said, is that Dan Cooper was a white male, 6 foot or 6 foot one, 170 to 175 pounds, mid 40s, which this factors in when we start getting to suspects. Olive complexion, brown eyes, black hair, hair parted on the left, and apparently left-handed. And Robert Gregory actually said that his hair was marshaled and that it was, you know, wavy. So if you look at the composite sketches, you won't see that. You won't see that hairstyle. But there was a sketch made later on, much later on, I think it wasn't even that many years ago, where they included that. And it gives him a different look. And he swears that this is the way his hair was. And Alice Hancock, who is the first class flight attendant, she backed up that observation that his hair was wavy. And he also stated that Cooper had on a russet sports jacket. Now, I didn't know what russet was either, but it's a reddish brown or similar to maroon in color. The only things that he left behind that could be tested later on, and of course, you know, in modern times, we have DNA, we have vacuums, we can suck up every little particle that was on an object. But he left behind a tie that had a mother of pearl tie pin on it. He left behind one of the parachutes, mm-hmm. or he left behind two parachutes. One had been opened and some of the lines cut. And then one of the primary chutes, the sporting chute, had been left behind. And then he also left behind fingerprints, apparently.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
There was supposed to be one. They said they found one fingerprint on the rail on the stairwell on the back of the plane, which is that stairwell wasn't used all the time. So they're pretty sure, fairly sure, that that fingerprint probably came from him and not a worker, engineer, whatever. So there was multiple. I mean, I think where they found like, 40 or 60 latent prints all over the plane. But I mean, with all the traffic, you know, you got the flight crew and the passengers, you know, it's hard to tell what's what there. But they figure they found many prints that they could tie to him. Comes into play later. But let's talk about this jump, because jumping out of an airplane, it's not rocket science, but it's not magical either, right? It's not an easy feat.
Well, it's not an easy feat when you're jumping at night in a storm into a forested area and you're not dressed for it.
Yeah. So there's a lot of discussion on, did he know what he was doing or not? I mean, he told them to fly at this height, at this speed, and he knew kind of what kind of chutes to ask for. That, you know, that tells me that he kind of knows what he's doing. He seems
depends on what you read, because in all the reading I've done, it seems that there are different accounts. Like, there's one account where supposedly he was told he was going to be offered all military chutes, just, you know, standard drop chutes, and he had said no to those. But that's something I have doubts about, because he actually chose a chute like that.
Yeah, he chose the drop chute, the military chute, over the sporting chute.
So that right there calls into question, and the fact that he took the dummy chute with him, it calls into question, what does he know about parachuting? After a while, they started to think, this guy may not know that much about parachuting, about skydiving, because he's choosing odd chutes. Now, I have heard some say that by choosing the chute that he did, that it would be better in the conditions he was in, because it would slow his descent better. And it would be better if he were to land into the trees with that chute, but
it's a more robust chute, so it can take the wind, take the weather. I mean, it's a military chute, so it's made for this stuff. Plus, it's at night and it's raining, so is he really going to know where to steer? I mean, but I think he had a military background, and that's why he chose the military chute, because he was more familiar with it.
But if it's true that he had said he didn't want the military drop chutes, then it calls that into question. And again, he has a 1 in 2 chance of choosing a chute.
Yeah.
There's only 2 to choose from for his primary chute, so it doesn't really matter. And then there's a 1 in 2 of choosing the correct, you know, secondary chute, and he didn't get that right. And then there's the question of, why is he going to do this in a storm?
Well, and so I didn't like any advanced skydiver or anybody that knowledgeable about skydiving would never do this in these kind of conditions. Well, I get that, but at the same time, this is a desperate situation. I mean, he probably had this planned, and he just, you know, once he bought that plane ticket, he had it in his head to fulfill this plan, regardless of conditions. So I don't really disregard him being an expert skydiver just because of the bad conditions. Maybe he was an expert skydiver and he thought he could handle the conditions. I just see it as a desperate situation, so it doesn't really matter.
Now, desperate might be true, but that would explain why he buys the ticket and then gets on board the plane. It's not like he bought it 8 months in advance or 6 months in advance. This is a guy that just went and got the ticket and did this. And so surely he would know that day that there was going to be weather. Now, it could be argued that he chose to go because the weather might help him escape. Like, maybe he thought it would be worth the risk. Yes, it's more dangerous for himself, but then it would also be more difficult for anyone to see him jump, and it'd be more difficult to find where he went because the weather would be poor, and it would give him a chance to get away. It has been suggested that, you know, he made the remark at one point that he said, that looks like Tacoma down there.
Yeah.
So if he knows the area, then perhaps what he's doing is he's jumping in an area where he's already got something planted. Maybe he has a vehicle in the area or he has someone ready to pick him up. But either way, if he's planned this out in, you know, down to the smallest detail, then we have to assume that he's willing to take certain risks, which include jumping into this winter storm.
Yeah. And my other kind of idea of why I think he has a military background is when he chooses the dummy chute, any experienced hobbyist or civilian skydiver would probably be able to tell that that was a dummy chute. And people say, well, he must have not known what he was doing or had been a novice or an amateur. But I think, well, if he was only if he was in the military, then he identifies the military parachute and he doesn't take the sporting chute. And in the military, maybe the training chutes don't have the same symbols or whatever to show you that it's a training chute. Because I know when I was in the military, we didn't have things identifying it as a training thing or not. They would actually use the real thing and just disable it, you know, whether it be a radio or even a grenade. They would take a real grenade and just hollow it out. And you really couldn't tell the difference between a real grenade and the fake grenade, except if you turned the thing over and looked at the bottom and you'd see one had a hole in it. So I wonder if that played a factor in why he chose this dummy chute for his reserve chute, because he should have known, he should have figured that out. He had the time to look at it and know he was strapping it on his body, but everyone else says he doesn't know what he was doing. And that's why he didn't know it was a dummy chute.
It was marked with an X. So apparently that is, according to the skydiver, this is how someone would be able to identify it was not a working chute.
Yeah. I guess my thing is that's how you identify it in the civilian world. Is that how you identify it in the military world, or does the military environment just use a regular chute and not, you know, not use a dummy chute? I don't know.
Yeah, it's difficult to say, because you would think that if this is a guy who's very calculating, he has time to check out all the chutes. Now, it could be that he breaks into that one of the working reserve chute, cuts the lines on it, and then later realizes that he's got a dummy chute that he didn't cut. But I would think that he wouldn't put it on.
No. I mean, he's already got the money strapped to him, and then he's got the primary chute. Why would he add more variables?
Yeah, it's just difficult to know. For all we know, it got tossed out or something. We just don't know. But it wasn't left on the plane like the other primary chute was, or the remains of the reserve chute that he had opened up.
So I don't know. I mean, I think he could have had his hand on the ripcord, jumped off the back thing, and hit that wind and that rain and everything. I mean, he wasn't dressed for it. But if he had his hand on the ripcord and as soon as he jumped, he pulled that ripcord, I think he has a chance to just at least get the chute deployed. I mean, if you want to break down the jump into pieces, I think he could have gotten got it deployed and stabilized his fall. Now, it's dark. He has no idea what, you know, he's going to hit when he gets to, you know, is he going to get a tree? Is he going to get a cliff? Or is he going to get a lake? Or is he going to get a perfect grassy knoll? I don't know. I think that the plane was going slow enough that I think he could have jumped and got the chute deployed. Now, whether or not he can make a graceful landing, that's a whole other argument to have. Do you think he could have gotten the chute deployed?
Well, it depends on when he's supposed to deploy his chute.
he could have deployed it immediately. I mean, you can deploy it sooner than later, and you're just floating for a longer time, and the wind might take you a lot further. Because the way a lot of the paratroopers do it in the military is they don't even have a ripcord that they pull themselves. It's pulled for them as they're jumping out of the plane. So I think he could have just pulled it immediately. As soon as he stepped off that thing, he could have pulled it, and it might have had a chance, as opposed to free-falling for a while and then pulling it later. But if he planned on doing that, then the force of the wind, the cold, and everything could have definitely disoriented him and prevented him from pulling the cord.
Well, that's one of the factors here, is that the sporting chute has an easier pull cord to deploy the chute, whereas the military one is not as easy to, you know, to find.
Nothing.
So he would have to know where – he'd have to be very aware of where it was when he was going out.
Yeah. Nothing in the military is convenient or easy.
But here's the thing. So he jumps at night into the storm, into what we assume is forested area. And this, along with the factor of the money, which has been recorded, is going to steer us in one direction or the other when we start forming opinions about – what happened to this guy? Because at this point, he's successful so far. He's successful. He's gotten his demands met, and then he's bailed from the plane. Mm-hmm. And apparently no one knows who he is. Now, this is where, before we go any further, I kind of want to clear up the Dan Cooper thing. Dan Cooper, as far as anyone knows, is a name that came from a comic book about a military hero named Dan Cooper. Are you familiar with this? Did you?
Yeah, he was a skydiver. He's a paratrooper.
And so it's no wonder that this man who hijacked the plane used this name. Now, a UPI news reporter was looking into this story as it was developing, and a clerk told him that they were hot on the trail of someone, and their name was D.B. Cooper. Well, it turns out that D.B. Cooper could not have been involved, but this UPI news reporter, hearing this name, ran with it, and I have to tell you, just as anybody else will tell you, D.B. Cooper sounds way cooler for a notorious criminal than Dan Cooper. Do you agree?
Yeah. I actually, on the original newscast, the guy gets it wrong there. He calls it D.A. Cooper. He doesn't say Dan Cooper. He doesn't say D.B. Cooper. He says D.A. Cooper. The media is really just not getting the name right. But D.B. Cooper sounded better, and it stuck, and that's why we call him D.B. Cooper today.
So he jumps, and from this point on, there's a lot of speculation because we don't know for certain that he deployed his chute. And so either he did or he didn't. And
flip a coin.
I suppose what's that?
Flip a coin.
Well, I'm not going to flip a coin. Yeah. I think we should fast forward a little bit because they actually search an area that, based on when he jumped and where they were, they actually search an area thinking they can find him, and they find nothing. And then, based on some information from one of the pilots that was flying behind, they decide there's probably another area they should search. But in all reality, this story doesn't really pick up again with anything conclusive until the year 1980. So it's quite a number of years later. And this is when there's a young boy by the name of Brian Ingram.
He's out picnicking with his family or something out in the woods.
Right, and he uses his hand at like a rake in the sand because he wants to prepare an area for a fire pit. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of pulling at the sand. Well, I think it's just a number of inches he gets down, and he starts finding money. And what he ends up finding are three packets totaling $5,800. And lo and behold, when they run the serial numbers, these are some of the bills that were given over to our Dan Cooper, a.k.a. D.B. Cooper.
So we lost some of the money. Now some of the money's, it's on like a riverbank. And not only is it kind of embedded on the shoreline, like buried in the sand, but it's said that they actually dredged that river and deposited that sand on that bank. So whether or not that money was washed up onto that shore and then kind of sunk down, or if it was part of a dredging and then deposited there, because nobody would leave money that close to water. They would put it more inland and somewhere where it wouldn't get wet.
There's theories here, and I don't like the idea that someone put it there on purpose. I don't like that at all. What's the point of hiding money when you're out in the middle of nowhere? You could just pocket that and go off somewhere.
Yeah.
But what they did was they studied the rivers in the area. Now, the Washougal and the Little Washougal rivers are apparently the rivers in that area that are capable of moving something like the packets of money, and they would move downstream. Well, if the money ended up falling into one of these rivers, it could have been moved on into the Columbia River and carried further south until it hit this area where the boy found it, which is known as Tina Bar. But as you said, if they dredged and brought it up and deposited on the, you know, nearby the river, then they may not have known that, because if you're dredging, I mean, how thick is that money going to be?
Yeah, and it could have broken up all the packs, you know, and they're probably just lucky that they had two packs, two complete packs, and then a third just kind of stuck to it. I mean, it could have just destroyed the money, and it could have gone everywhere. The rubber bands holding it together could have disintegrated. They're really lucky that they were able to recover any of this money. It's almost like, you know, winning the lottery at this point.
So this is, I think, a big clue. And I think finding this money, and then it should be said, obviously, that no other money has ever turned up. Not a single 20 from the rest of the money that has never been recovered has ever shown up anywhere. So we have some scenarios here. We could have a scenario where he deploys his chute, but when he does, the money gets blown off of his body. Because there's sort of a jerking motion. When he deploys that chute, he can get thrown a bit, and it could dislodge the money, and it could go just flying off into, well, it might as well be the dark abyss here at this point, and it could have fallen into a river. Or he deployed his chute, he landed, he got away, and then something happened that prevented him from ever using the money, and that it's hidden somewhere. Or he went out into the weather and he was desperate and he miscalculated. And so when he went out, he wasn't able to deploy and he ended up slamming into the ground somewhere or into the river or into trees.
Yeah, trees. And then it rips the money out from him, you know, whatever. But the money gets to the water somehow. So either he landed in the water or the money landed in the water and he landed somewhere else.
Yeah, so far I like the water idea. And if he goes into the river, he could sink down into the bottom of that. Or if he gets carried along, it's I doubt he got carried along. But if the money got carried along, it could end up in a way like far away from wherever it had landed originally.
If he didn't deploy the chute and he just hit the ground doing, you know, terminal velocity.
Yeah, that would be terminal velocity, wouldn't it?
I mean, they searched and they searched and they didn't find him, but this is finding a needle in a haystack, and this is the wilderness. So animals probably could have gotten to his body. You know, the elements got to his body, got to his pack, whatever. So there's, I mean, if they didn't find him in the first couple months, he probably could have disintegrated at that point. I mean, bones would be left possibly if animals didn't get to those. I know a hunter or something found a emergency exit sign out in those same woods.
And yeah, placard.
Yeah, placard. So probably.
And it came from the plane, did it not?
Yeah, it did.
So that's a good sign that something that we could trace back to the plane was actually found. They also found a skull, and they studied it and determined that it was a woman's skull. So that was ruled out. They also ended up finding a parachute that had been buried, but they determined that that wasn't related either. So modern day, they can test the tie that was left behind, and they extracted DNA from that tie. And apparently the DNA is, as time has gone on, they've taken the stance that it's less and less likely to really be of much use. They've used it to say these suspects aren't good suspects, but again, it's, they can't say, oh, well, we'll use it to prove it's this person. They can't really do that. They can use it to say, well, it's definitely not this person. So it's tricky business. And then you have the fingerprints, but they don't have good fingerprints for everybody. So it's tough to use that as well, although it's nice to have fingerprints that may belong to the person.
And that's the problem, is the DNA on the tie and the fingerprints might not be from him. I mean, they think it's a pretty good idea or assumption that they are his, but we just cannot say that these are his until they match somebody else. So,
yeah, and that would be a real find.
Yeah.
Well, before we get to the suspects, I'd like to talk about the fallout from the hijacking on the crew. Because this being a hijacking, these flight attendants, these crew members, they felt it. There are real repercussions for them in their lives. Tina Mucklow, she spent a lot of time next to Cooper. And so that was in 71. Somewhere around 79, 80, she becomes a cloistered nun for 12 years. And she ends up changing her name.
Wow.
She's had people try to interview her. Once she became a nun, she was pretty much impossible to track down. You couldn't talk to her. But before that, she seemed, especially when she first got into being, when she first became a nun, I should say, someone spoke with her, but she just would say she couldn't remember. It's as though, they say it's like her mind was wiped clean and she had sort of pushed all that away.
Well, even in the initial interview with her, like freshly after the thing, she blew off the reporter. She's like, we already talked about this. You already talked to the pilot, and we said that we'd rather you ask the FBI than us. I mean, she's very aloof even then. So no, not a lot of interest to talk about this event.
But the co-pilot of the plane was impressed with her. And in fact, he bought her some really nice perfume on behalf of the crew. It was Chanel No. 5. Oh. And before she became a nun, she's someone who liked to look nice and smell nice. And then she became a nun. And nothing against nuns, but this is a woman who must have had trouble. And we can presume this because she became a nun. She changed her whole life up. And Florence Schaffner, the one who was given the note in the beginning, she became very paranoid. And right after this happened, she took 30 days leave. And they say that she became very paranoid, that she, when she would start a car, she would turn it over really slowly. And she would check around the car, nervous that there was a bomb. And she feared that Cooper would come back for her because she was a witness. She was never the same since this happened.
And that's sad, because out of all the hijackers, he was probably the most well-behaved guy. But at the same time, it is a guy holding you hostage, kidnapping you literally with a bomb. So that's going to have an impact. Did the pilots fare any better?
Yeah, not much on the pilots. You know, a lot of pilots have military backgrounds. They're probably used to more adverse situations. But yeah, there's no real information, so it's difficult to say whether they had any trouble or not. I would imagine if he's buying her Chanel No. 5 after the incident that he's not having too much trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
He's more of a, wow, I really think you did a great job handling this situation, and we want to thank you. Mm-hmm. And like I said, that was himself and the crew working together to find a way to thank her. And she was the one who went through the most, because she had to spend a lot of time sitting next to this hijacker. Did you want to get into the suspects now?
Yeah. There was a letter written, or several letters written, but one of them was written right after the event. was like a few days after the event, and it was, you know, signed by D.B. Cooper or whatever. And people claim that if you move letters around and do certain things, it has a secret message saying Cooper was Kenny or Kenny was Cooper. And the first suspect is Kenneth Christensen. People say that he is the most likely of the suspects, but I don't know if you agree with that or not. But what's up with Kenneth?
Well, no, you got into these letters. I'd like to talk about the letters real quick. You've seen the letters, right?
Yeah.
How are they signed?
They were signed D.B. Cooper, right?
Okay, well, let's stop there.
Yeah.
D.B. Cooper. What name did he sign on the ticket when he bought the ticket?
Dan Cooper.
Okay. I'm already calling BS on the letters.
Yeah. I mean, the one that was sent 3 days after, I almost think I could almost give it a pass by saying, oh, the media is getting my name wrong, so I'm going to go ahead and just roll with it. But the other letters, I don't buy at all, because none of the letters are very similar in style or anything. One guy, he was showing a letter from Kenneth and saying, oh, the handwriting matches up. And I didn't see it at all. I didn't think it matched up at all. I was looking at it. I'm like, okay, I think you're pulling at straws here. But I don't think I would side with you that the letters are BS, but the first one is kind of interesting to me. The rest of them, I think, are hoaxes. But would he be able to parachute down, get everything together, and send a letter all in that time, you know?
Well, why risk exposing yourself further? Why not leave it a mystery whether you survived or not?
Yeah, there's no reason.
It almost seems like, well, I took all these precautions, but now I'm going to start sending letters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
It makes no sense, and I think he would have signed it Dan Cooper again. Mm-hmm. It just, to me, it just doesn't make sense that he goes with what the media had been calling him when he never used that name. You were talking about Kenneth Christensen, and yeah, his brother Lyle is the one who implicated him in this hijacking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, Kenneth, he had a paratrooper background. He was a smoker, and he was also left-handed, and he had what a remote resemblance to the artist's rendition sketch?
No. not Kenneth Christensen. Not according to what I've read.
Yeah, okay.
The problem with him is when the investigators check him out, there are a couple of major holes in the idea that he could be a real suspect. One of which is he worked for NWA, which is the airline that was hijacked.
Okay.
So why would he show up possibly on an airline where he would know the people on board, because he would be interacting with the crews change all the time. So he might end up running across people he knows.
But people would argue that it was him because then he knew how the back stairwell functioned and he had some knowledge of the airplane.
But no, he may not have known how the aft stairs worked, because he actually asked one of the flight attendants to show him how it worked.
I'm playing devil's advocate. That's some of the websites I read where this is why he was Kenneth, or, you know, so I read a lot of crappy websites out there with a lot of bad information.
Okay. Yeah. There is a lot of bad information out there. He also doesn't match the description, what I understand, at all.
Yeah.
So, but I would say the major thing that they used was that he worked for the airline, and it's just, yeah, it just doesn't seem reasonable that he would take that chance that he would be recognized, so that they would say, oh, that's not Cooper, that's, you know, whoever. Lyle Christensen really believed that his brother was D.B. Cooper, Dan Cooper, and he started sending letters to someone to pass on to Nora Ephron, the director. Mm-hmm. And he started getting upset because he had heard that she's getting these letters, but she's not responding. So it was just kind of interesting. It almost sounded to me as if he was trying to make money off of this.
Yeah, and then I guess Lyle claims that the deathbed confession that Kenneth said, there's something you should know, but I can't tell, and never really went into detail. And Lyle says that, you know, he said this remark, but what, I mean, hey, you know, on my deathbed, I might have a lot of things that I should tell people that I'm not going to. So what does that mean? But yeah, so that's Kenneth. A lot of people think he's the most viable guy, but
you could say that about any one of these suspects.
Yeah.
Because I'll just say it right now, I don't see us going through every suspect name.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
No problem. And what are the top ones that you want to discuss? We don't have to go through all of them.
Well, let's go on to Dwayne Weber.
Okay.
Dwayne Weber was left-handed. Mm-hmm. He had marsled hair, so his hair was wavy. It fits that description. He was a World War II vet, so age-wise, yeah, it works. He's actually, of all these suspects, he's actually someone who's served time.
Yeah.
He served time in 6 different prisons between 45 and 68. And so he seemed to be a decent suspect. So DNA was submitted and fingerprints were submitted to check against the database that they have for the Cooper case. And here's where the trouble steps in, is both of those failed to match. So again, you could argue, well, the DNA isn't reliable and the fingerprints, those might not be reliable either. We just suspect that maybe his because of where some of them were left, but it's not conclusive. So he's one of those guys that there are people who are, they're just adamant that he is probably that guy.
Yeah, they say that he admitted to his wife that he was DB Cooper, or he was Dan Cooper, but she didn't recognize the name. It's kind of hearsay that he walked along the riverbank where the Tina Bar area. But okay, how would he know? I mean, that suggests that he's planting or putting the money there, which nobody in their right mind would bury, you know, dig a hole and bury their money right next to water. So I don't really take that allegation as fact. I mean, maybe he was walking around in that area, sure, fine. But to actually say, oh, he walked along the Tina Bar, you know, riverbank, and then, you know, later on, that's when Brian Ingram found the money. It's like, well, then he's an idiot if he actually buried the money on a watery riverbank. So I don't believe that at all either. And then, you know, the final nail in the coffin, like you said, is when his fingerprints and DNA doesn't match. So I think he was just a guy that was obsessed with the Cooper case.
And well, we can say this right now. Yeah. When you have an infamous case like this, there will be people who will try to take credit. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talked about this on the when we talked about the JFK assassination. When you have a huge event happen that takes over the media, you have people who, up until that day, have been nobodies. No one's even given them a second look. And here's a chance for them when they're desperate for attention or have aspirations of being well-known or famous or infamous, will want to take credit for something or inject themselves into a story so that they'll be interviewed, so they'll be on the news.
Yeah.
Or at least even in their own little circle of people, oh, wow, look, I'm amazing now. You thought I was a nobody? Well, look at this.
And it's crazy that police have to weed out the crazies that try to take credit for murders and whatnot. It's baffling to me that they have to hold back information from the press and the public so they can weed out people that claim they've committed these crimes. Because we've seen overzealous prosecutors take people at their word. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I'll go over this guy a little more quickly, but William Gossett, he was former Marine Corps, former Army Air Force veteran. He was in Vietnam and Korea, and he had jump training, and he retired from military service in 1973. And it should be said that he at one point had become a paranormal radio host, but in 88, he changed his name to Wolfgang and became a priest. Well, so one of the major researchers on this case is Galen Cook, and he says, ooh, he must be trying to disguise his identity. And I think that's funny because he's going to wait until 88 to disguise his identity. Yeah. Or does he remember when this happened?
Yeah, it was 15 years almost.
Yeah, so I think this is really funny. And it just goes to show that you can have a guy, they attach their name to a case, they've written about it, they're the go-to person to interview, but even then, it doesn't mean that they are any better at analyzing this case than anyone else. You know what I'm saying? If Galen Cook seems to think that there's something to this guy, that's an opinion. There's nothing actually linking this William Gossett to the case.
No, that one's, I'm surprised you even brought it up because it's just like that one had nothing to it. I thought you were going to bring up the Richard McCoy guy.
No, we'll get to him. But
okay.
I just don't like these vague things where like Galen Cook says that he talked to someone else and that person who was a passenger on the hijacked aircraft says, oh, there's a physical detail which no one can know about that both the hijacker and Gossett have. Yeah. So it's like, ooh, maybe this is the guy. But I mean, that's like a really bad rumor, and I just can't take it seriously. I think this is this is one of the worst suspects out there.
No, definitely, it just doesn't make any sense.
But sure, we can move on to Richard McCoy Jr., Army veteran. He served in Vietnam. He was a helicopter pilot with the Green Berets. Why not him, right? I mean, after all, he did board a 727 the next year, and with what looked like a hand grenade and a handgun, and demanded four parachutes and $500,000.
It's the same MO, you know, but he wasn't the same. I mean, to me, he wasn't the same demeanor as the D.B. Cooper of before. He was a little bit different. And, I mean, there was similarities in the hijacking, but I didn't find similarities in their personality. Let's put it that way. He seemed a little bit more brash. He seemed a little bit more, I don't know, just violent as compared to the original hijacking, where Dan Cooper was more polite, I guess.
Well, we talked about this, and I said, you know, if you want to stretch it, if you want to make it fit, you could say that D.B. Cooper, something went wrong with the first one. Mm-hmm. And so this time he was actually angry that he had to go through this all again.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I guess.
But there are some issues with this with this suspect, and they're kind of difficult to just dismiss. They sort of shoot holes in this guy as a suspect, and that's sort of a joke because he was killed in a shootout with FBI agents after he escaped from prison. After he was in there for 2 years, he escaped from prison, and he ended up dying in a shootout with the FBI. But yeah, he's got some major issues. The age, and they believe that he just knew too much about skydiving that he would have approached the whole parachutes situation differently than Dan Cooper did. So that's part of it too. And then also, they actually have evidence that shows that he was not in that area, in the area when Dan Cooper hijacked that plane, that he was actually in Las Vegas.
Yeah,
so
before, yeah.
It's just, it's not likely that it was him, especially, I think the age is probably one of the major problems. Although some might say you can get someone's age wrong. You know, if he's only 12, 13 years difference in looks, perhaps not in age, then yeah, he could fool you. If Dan Cooper was younger than he appeared, then
that's
possible.
That's what smoking and drinking bourbon does. It makes you look older.
That's possible. You know, they say that when he was sitting there smoking, that he smoked at least 8 cigarettes. So he was smoking one after the other.
I'm so glad that by the time I was flying on airplanes, that they'd put in a smoking ban, because I couldn't even imagine being stuck in an airplane with everyone smoking, chain smoking like that. It's just,
but it'd be awful. But I can say this: it's someone remarked that it's too bad they didn't have the cigarette butts still, because they were collected.
Yeah,
if they had the cigarette butts, they'd have a great DNA profile of Dan Cooper.
Yeah,
but you know, they didn't keep track of them. No one knows where they're at. And hell, I didn't even get the sense that whoever had originally collected them tried that hard to find them. But maybe I'm wrong on that. Yeah.
But I think Richard McCoy, he got the most press because he was a copycat hijacking. He, you know, did all the same things that D.B. Cooper did. There's a book called The Real McCoy, and the FBI agent that ended up shooting McCoy, he said, you know, he's quoted, "When I shot Richard McCoy, I also shot D.B. Cooper at the same time." So that gives more credence to his profile as being D.B. Cooper. But I think when the FBI agent said that, he wasn't saying, "I believe that this guy was D.B. Cooper." I think he was saying, "I was shooting D.B. Cooper or, you know, ransom hijackers when I shot Richard McCoy." But it's all up for interpretation there. I mean, it could be either way.
And a few years ago, a woman named Marla Cooper came out and said, "I think my uncle was D.B. Cooper." Uh-huh. And so she pointed to Lynn Doyle Cooper, who apparently had been around the family quite a bit up until after the incident, the hijacking. And then he disappeared. Now, he didn't disappear into thin air. He actually just went away. But he had marshaled hair, wavy hair, and he was a Korean War veteran. And apparently he and another one of her uncles was out turkey hunting that day. That's what's said. But the day before the hijacking, he and that uncle were actually talking about some sort of plan they had, and they were using these radios, testing these radios out. I think they were like CB radio type things or walkie-talkies. Yeah. There you go, walkie-talkies. And then the day after the hijacking, he shows back up and his shirt's bloody. His white shirt is bloody. And he said that it was due to an auto accident, but he seemed, according to her, that he and the uncle had started talking about money troubles being over, things of that nature. So she suspects that he is D.B. Cooper.
That's an interesting case because he has an alibi. He was out turkey hunting, and it's Thanksgiving, so it does kind of make sense that he might be out turkey hunting. But at the same time, is this plan with walkie-talkies, is that he's meeting his friend out in the woods and blah, blah, blah? Or is that just two guys just being stupid together? And, you know, I mean, that's what we do. So, and then later on, his obsession with, you know, the comic book or whatever it is. I don't know. Now,
Have no verification. I'd like to add that we don't have, as far as I'm aware, any verification that he was obsessed with that comic book hero. That's something that's said. So
we don't even have verification that he was actually wearing a bloody shirt. I mean, this is just her story, right?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that shoots a hole in her story, you know, never mind him, but she actually said that the FBI has told her that, you know, this case is essentially over now. We know it was him. You know, you're right. It had to have been him. Well, if you talk to the FBI, and some of the FBI agents have been vocal about this, they'll say, yeah, we've reached no conclusions yet on that. So they're not operating with this as its case closed. In fact, the case is still open.
Yeah. In fact, there was, I don't remember if it was a couple of years ago, but FBI agent Carr went on the news and was showing off all the evidence and everything and going on talk shows. And he said, I want to raise awareness because this is a active open case. And if we can get it back in the public eye and somebody remembers something, maybe we can close the case. So if it was her uncle, then why would this agent be out there on talk shows right now? So I was surprised by, in 1970s, how many hijackings happened. I mean, it seemed to just be out of control back then. And then you see a sharp decline in hijackings in the 1980s, 1990s. And then you see a huge decline in any kind of air incidents after, you know, September 11th. But after D.B. Cooper, I mean, and after the 1970s, really, they changed the way airlines operated and their security, right? I mean, this was a game changer in our industry. And they implemented metal detectors. I think they put, you know, locks on the cabin doors, the cockpit doors. I mean, D.B. Cooper in the 1970s pretty much changed the way we fly today. They don't use those stairwells anymore. They either don't, you know, if they had them on the airplane, they welded them shut, or they just, you know, phased them out through attrition, and they don't install those kind of things anymore on the planes.
Well, for a while there, they'd actually devised a mechanism that when the plane would take off, that something would slide over and block it from opening.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lock. And then once it landed, it would actually slide back out of the way. It would, so it could be used.
Yeah.
But that didn't stay around very long. They ended up actually just preventing those things from opening anymore. You know, that they kept that for a little while, but after time, they just stopped using the aft stairwell. It just, you know, at this point, look at it this way. In 71, you have D.B. Cooper. In 72, there are 15 hijackings.
Yeah.
That's a large amount. And that should tell you, you know, why would they change up how they deal with airports? Well, it's because now there's this huge risk. I mean, they don't want people just hijacking these planes. So that would just kill the industry. So something had to be done.
Yeah. And, you know, people always hear about Sky Marshals today. Well, we had Sky Marshals or a Sky Marshal program back in the 1970s. You know, that was something that they started doing then because of the hijackings. You know, they started searching everybody's bags. They started going through everyone's stuff. And I remember, you know, when I was a real kid, you know, real young kid, I remember people yelling about the invasion of their privacy when they flew on planes. And, you know, and we really hear about it now with the TSA. That's what they had to do at that point. I mean, you get somebody in charge of a jet and they can fly it into anything. It's a scary thing. So
the area out by where the money was found, there's a place known as Aerial Store. Mm-hmm. And it's on State Route 503, which I found kind of interesting because the flight was 305, 305. And this is State Route 503. Mm-hmm. And it's a store, but it's a bar. And they actually have a DB Cooper lookalike contest. They discuss the case there, especially when it's the Saturday after Thanksgiving every year. They have a kind of a special event going on. They have a front room with tables, and they have DB Cooper aerial store hats and shirts. And they actually have like a white parachute hanging from the ceiling. And then in the bar area, they have like a makeshift dance floor, and they'll have like a live band playing. And then in one of the corners, they actually have sort of a shrine area to DB Cooper with news articles. And there's even like a deer that has like the sunglasses. And I don't know, it's just kind of humorous to me that they have, they're really celebrating this case, just like Roswell, New Mexico does with the Roswell UFO incident.
That's what I was thinking of when you were saying it was, it just sounds like Roswell. Why does DB Cooper get, I mean, why do people idolize this guy? I mean, he's a hijacker. I mean, he hijacked a plane and, you know, essentially got away with it. I mean, why do people think he's an anti-hero or whatever?
Well, Ocean's 11 was a popular film, was it not? And I think people have this fantasy of doing something bad, but not too bad. You know, no one died. So I think they look at him and think, oh, wow, it's so cool how he's able to pull that off. No one else has. So he got away. No one knows who he really is. And the money's never been located. So whether he's alive or dead, you know, in a lot of people's minds, I think they look at him and think, well, he got away with it.
Yeah, it's like a big F you to the man. But, you know, at the same time, I used to think he was a cool cat and, you know, guy in a business suit. That's just, you know, ridiculous. But the more I studied the case and everything, the less I feel like I need to idolize him.
Well, they're not letting him go. In 1976, late 1976, the authorities realized that, you know, this guy is, there's going to be a statute of limitations coming up. So they needed to do something. So they sought an indictment for him. And so they named it John Doe, a.k.a. D.B. Cooper. And they issued this against him, against the hijacker of Northwest Flight 305. So they can keep looking.
Yeah.
Because they've actually issued an indictment against him.
Which is, it's interesting that they've literally indicted somebody that they don't even know is alive, somebody that they don't know who it is. So it's an interesting way that the law worked that way, because I just assume that how you indict somebody when you haven't charged or arrested them yet.
Well, I think it's their admission that even though I think most people believe he didn't, you know, like most of the authorities don't believe that he got away with this, that he's dead. Well, you could say he got away with it because they didn't name him. They didn't catch him. They didn't even find his body. But
yeah.
I think it's their way of saying, just in case we find some information that it's someone who did get away with it, we can still hold them accountable. So justice never rests.
Yeah, exactly.
And the plane in question, I think this is kind of interesting, was sort of sold here and there throughout time. And then eventually a commemorative plaque was installed aboard the plane, denoting its connection to Cooper's, you know, hijacking and his jump.
And Brian Ingram actually got to keep some of the money that he found on that bank, and he sells it now in auction. And yeah, he doesn't donate it to anything. He keeps the money, but I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, he's had to sell some of it because he needed the money. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I know his mother expressed regret that they ever found it. Mm-hmm. And to hear her say it, it's almost like she says that this whole event, finding the money, helped to break her and her husband up.
Hmm.
So
interesting.
They've made films on this. In 1981, The Pursuit of D.B. Cooper, Treat Williams, star of Dead Heat, I believe.
Yeah.
plays Cooper, and Robert Duvall is his former military commander. And yeah, I saw some footage of it. It doesn't really remind me of this too much, but you know, it's a movie. There's actually a film that's a comedy. I haven't seen it, but someone was telling me about it. It's about the hunt for Cooper's loot, and it's called Without a Paddle. I don't know if you've seen this movie. It's a comedy.
Yeah, it's dumb, but it's fun. But there is a great YouTube channel called Redneck Mystery Hunter. And this guy was on the hunt for D.B. Cooper. And that's where I got most of my information for this podcast.
Yeah.
I'm totally kidding. But I did watch it. It was ridiculous. But
yeah, if you're interested in all of the evidence that they were able to glean from this case, there's a really good site. It's titled citizensleuths.com. And you can pour through the evidence, the money that was found, the theories about the Washougal River, information on Tina Barr, where the money was found, all of the particles and things that were found on the tie, including the DNA, any kind of conclusions they've reached. They have images. So, yeah, if you want to take this case further than we took it, then by all means, check out citizensleuths.com. I think it's a really interesting website. It's driven by citizens, but I believe they were pretty good help, I think, to this case and to anyone who's curious about it.
Yeah, that was the main site that I was checking out.
And I'm sure that anyone listening to this, especially if they had an interest in this case before we started discussing it, have their own theories about what happened. I'll just repeat mine real quick. I think he made the jump because he had to. I think he was desperate. And it was either I'm going to die or I'm going to be able to save myself with this money. And he made the jump. And I would say, based on those planes not seeing anyone jump out of that plane, I think it's because he didn't deploy his chute. I think he went, he got thrown down, and I think he probably went into a river somewhere and died immediately. And that's why none of the money has ever been spent, because he died. I think if he had lived, I think that money would have been spent somehow.
My theory is a little bit more complicated. I think he made the jump. I think the money was ripped from his body, and he landed, collected his chute, licked his wounds, and went back into society without the money. Because they never found a chute. They never found his body. Again, with time and elements, it could have just, you know, gone away. But I think that they did a lot of searching, and I would have figured they might have found him or some remnants of him if he just hit the ground and died, unless he went in the water, and then anything could have happened.
Well, there's debate to this day exactly where he would have landed if he had landed.
Yeah.
And so it's a great amount of territory you're talking about. And when you start thinking about, yeah, exactly the amount of area that they're having to look at, I'd say it's pretty easy to lose him.
In today's world, when we got planes and helicopters searching for growing operations, you know, and they can pinpoint them in mountaintops, I would hope that their search and rescue team would have been able to find him back then. But if he's dead, then he's not making a lot of noise. But even if he's alive, he's probably not trying to draw attention to himself either. I don't know. I think he might have made it, but if he did make it, he didn't make it with the money.
Yeah, I can see that. Either way, yeah. I don't think he had the money once he exited that plane. I think that was it.
Either way, it was a major fail.
Well, you know, some would say it was a success because he wasn't caught. He wasn't actually discovered. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like you could say it's either a win-win or a lose-lose.
Yeah. I guess you can be 90% successful, but if you fail in the last 10%, whether that be failing to have the money or killing yourself, then it's a fail.
Well, he wasn't caught.
Yeah.
So he that's a success. He may not have gotten the money, but if we assume that he was desperate, then I think that's why the authorities believe, that's another reason they would believe he's dead, is because if he really was desperate, he would have tried something else to get the money. Mm-hmm. One thing that was said while he was on the plane was he was asked, you know, do you have a grudge against this airline? And he said, no, I just have a grudge.
Grudge.
So it's interesting. It's, what's this grudge about?
I'm not part of your system.
Throw it on the ground.
Exactly. Exactly.
So interesting case. I think it's one of those, it's one of those cases where it still could be solved. I think, I don't think we're looking at a Jack the Ripper case here. I think this is something that could still be solved, but
yeah,
you know, as time goes on, it's, you know, our technology, our research could be better, but there's also, there are witnesses that go, that get lost. There's evidence that's no longer as useful. So it's, as you get better, other things get worse, but I still think it's possible they could solve it. Do you see them solving this, or do you think this is, this will just be a mystery from here on out?
They're going to need a break. And this case, they say it's the Cooper curse, where you get evidence that you think is going to solve the case, but then it goes nowhere. I think the case is solvable if they just get the right break, but I think it takes time, and sometimes you have a window of opportunity, and that window might be closed. But if they get a match, hey, they've got it. But that guy would be in his 70s or 80s now, if he's still alive.
Yeah, he would be probably 80s or 90.
Yeah.
Because, the you know, if you go by the eyewitnesses, they say he was in his 40s. That was 71. We're now in 2015, so.
But he was a chain smoker and a drinker, so I don't think he lived to his 90s.
No. I think it's probably more likely that if he had survived, which I don't really put stock in that myself, but if he had, yeah, probably didn't make it to 2000, maybe even, so.
Yeah.
It's just difficult to say.
Yeah.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.